From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So what would you do? Imagine you're Charles Darwin, and for years you've been working out this theory about how natural selection affects evolution. You're compiling your research, you're starting to write what you're certain will be a monumental scientific breakthrough, and then you receive a letter in the mail, an essay that contains basically the same idea as yours. What would you do? Well, this scenario actually played out. Darwin gets a manuscript in the mail in 1858, a year before he publishes his seminal work. It came from the subject of our program today, a fascinating and eccentric scientist named Alfred Russel Wallace. Darwin gets the acclaim and the credit ultimately, but what happens to Wallace? Well, stick around and find out from the Harvard lecturer Andrew Berry after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The biologist and historian Andrew Berry says, by all rights, the scientific community should really be celebrating the 100 years since the death of Alfred Russel Wallace in 1913. You'd think, he says, there would be conferences and exhibits, books and articles, but it's not really what's happening, and there's a good chance most of you don't have a clue who Alfred Russel Wallace even was. Well, it turns out he came up with the theory of natural selection. Yes, so did Charles Darwin, of course, and he is the man who gets credit for it. But the truth is, Wallace's ideas about evolution were remarkably similar to Darwin's, and he came about them at basically the same time in history. But Andrew Berry says Wallace will always be Watson to Darwin's Holmes. And there are a lot of reasons for that, which we're going to talk about today. We're profiling the life of Alfred Russel Wallace today, a visionary scientist, a daring explorer, an outspoken socialist. We'll also talk about his scientific legacy as well. We got the idea from Flora Lichtman, of all people, former producer at Science Friday. Flora has co-produced a short documentary about Wallace. It's going to be up on our website, Video West, just after the program today. We invite you to join us today, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Andrew Berry, evolutionary biologist, lecturer at Harvard University. He edited a collection of A.R. Wallace's writings. That book is called Infinite Tropics, and he's joining us today from a studio on the campus of Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Andrew Berry, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning. A pleasure to be here.
Like, I guess the most obvious question, I'm wondering when it is that you first encountered Alfred Russel Wallace. When did you first learn of him, or have you always sort of had a known who the man was?
So I'm a professional biologist, and I had a lot of biological education, and I think I had the standard awareness of Wallace, which is he was a footnote. So you read about Darwin and the Beagle and all those adventures. And then, and by the way, there was someone else. And so there it was at the bottom of the page in 8-point Pico font or something. that was the full extent of my knowledge until, I'm going to say, about 1999, when I was asked to review a book about Alfred Russel Wallace. And that kind of, well, it forced me to drag him out of his footnote and read some biographical material, also to start reading some of the of his own copious writings. And I had an experience that many people do when they encounter Wallace, once you get beyond the footnote, so to speak. I fell in love with him.
Mm. We'll get to some particulars as we go. But when you look at kind of the litany of his scientific achievements, you have to wonder why most of us haven't heard of him in many ways. We'll get to the particulars of his ideas about natural selection, but maybe mention some of the other achievements that he went through because they're pretty noteworthy, it seems.
A truly extraordinary sort of general purpose biologist. He's sort of best celebrated, obviously, for discovering actually both strands of the theory of evolution. So the first part, which is the fact that things are descended from other things and diverge through time, that's what Darwin called descent with modification. Mm-hmm. So that's generation to generation change. And then the second part of that, of course, is how do you make that change from generation to generation useful? That's natural selection. So that twofer is obviously the biggie, the headliner. But he was very interested in the geographical distribution of organisms. Yeah. He was interested specifically in, well, today we'd call it the interaction between plate tectonics, between continental drift and the distribution of animals and plants. He obviously didn't know about continental drift, which is very much a 20th century theory, but he was very interested in reconstructing the past history of the planet, the geological history of the planet, in terms of the distribution of animals and plants across the face of the planet. So he was a father of what I suppose we call the field of evolutionary biogeography, which is itself a major undertaking in its own right. He was the grand old man, and absolutely, I would say, the most experienced tropical biologist of his day. He spent 12 long years in the field, 4 in the New World in Brazil and 8 in the Old World in Southeast Asia. Yeah. So he really had this extraordinarily encyclopedic knowledge of tropical ecology, tropical biology. And he used that as a basis to write on all sorts of things, whether he was interested in how new species arise, the specifics of the process of what we call speciation. He was interested in what today we call conservation. That name wasn't even really coined at that stage. He was interested in developing ideas which would become fundamental to ecology.
It seems like one of his gifts was, you write about his ability to, just seems observation. You talk about his gifts about spotting patterns, for example. And this idea, which you say that he could sort of generate this mental database of things that he could sort of refer to later. Was it a photographic memory or something like that?
It can't have been far off a photographic memory. Now, this isn't in any way peculiar to or specific to Wallace. It's the mark of all the great naturalists. Yeah. And it's certainly true that Darwin had it as well. It's that ability. You spend some time studying beetles. Both these guys grew up with an interest in beetles. And you become familiar with the different species around. And then you can extrapolate from what you know. So then when you go to Brazil, you know that this slightly different beetle is clearly some what we would call a relative in the evolutionary sense of the word, yeah, of the ones you saw back in England. And what you're doing is an extraordinary amount of data processing when you're making that comparison. As the beetle runs across the path in front of you, bang, you are comparing it to your database of all previously encountered beetles and recognizing, if you like, where it fits in. It's the mark of a true and great naturalist. And Darwin, there's a nice essay that Wallace wrote late in life saying, why was it us? You know, there are plenty of other smarter people out there who could have discovered this theory. And he says, in a very humble way, and I think it's rather charming, and I think it's true, he says it's because we both studied beetles.
Yeah, and collected them, right?
Yeah, obsessively, I hasten to add.
So what I mean, we'll get to the reasons for all of this, but give me a general sense of why it is you figure his name has faded from popular view.
There are, I'm going to say, three major strands, one of which I'm going to call post-mortem fading, which is he, certainly from the perspective of evolutionary biologists, indeed many of the straight sort of materialists slash naturalists for whom Darwin is such a champion, found that many of his beliefs, non-scientific beliefs, he became a spiritualist, for example. He thought that phrenology was this ancient idea that you could determine the capacities and indeed capabilities of a person by feeling the lumps of their skull. He believed that that was – he described it in 1898 as the true science of mind. Yeah. He blotted his copybook a lot in terms of embracing some pretty damn wacky ideas. So that's idea one, that we're just sort of uneasy. We don't want our scientific heroes to have quite such thoroughgoing feet of clay.
Right.
The second one is in his own time, actually, and I think people don't really appreciate this. He was always very secondary to Darwin. He really was. There's a whole bunch of cartoons that came out in the satirical literature about evolution after the publication of The Origin of Species, and they feature Darwin and indeed several other of the leading Victorian biologists of the day, his colleague, the Darwin's Bulldog, famously, Thomas Henry Huxley. There are none that I have been able to find that feature Alfred Russel Wallace. So even then, he was very much second string.
Is it a personality issue? I mean, he tended to sort of fade in the background naturally?
There's an element of that, yeah. I think. But I mean, there's also a structural element. He'd serendipitously, because he didn't plan it that way, he became coupled with Darwin. When Darwin was significantly older. Darwin was 14 years older. Yeah. Darwin was already extremely well established. So the Voyage of the Beagle, his book, had been a bestseller. I mean, he was a big guy, big man of science. Wallace was a nobody. Okay, and I do think there's a structural problem when you hitch your – if you're a nobody and you hitch your wagon to a big-time somebody, you kind of disappear, if you see what I mean. Yeah. But the other fact of the matter is that, of course, it was Darwin who published On the Origin of Species. So, yes, they jointly discovered the ideas which are laid out and explored in great detail in The Origin of Species. That's the 1858 co-publication of Evolution by Natural Selection. But, you know, that's a scientific paper. It's read by a few, well, the Victorian equivalents of nerds, I suppose. It was the best-selling Origin of Species that put the idea out there, put it on the map, and it was very much Darwin who was identified with that. But on the personality front, you're dead right. There's something I've described it as almost pathologically modest about Wallace. He didn't – so actually he was planning – we've actually only discovered this fairly recently. It seems he was planning while he was in Indonesia to write a book which would have been his Origin of Species. Yeah. And he nixed the project when he discovered that Charles Darwin was already doing it. So there was no – you know, it was redundant. So he didn't actually write a great book on evolution until actually several years after Darwin had died. He actually toured North America, went through Salt Lake City, I seem to remember, and given a bunch of lectures on evolution and other things. And people have said, these are great lectures. You've really explained things well. I've read The Origin, but I understand everything much better after your lectures. Why don't you write them down? So he wrote them down, and this is his sort of single most solid and consistent statement of about evolution. What did he title that book?
Yeah.
Darwinism.
Right. That's baffling, I think, in some way. It was a terrible self-marketer, I guess. Was this stiff upper lip sort of Victorian sensibility, or was it just, again, just the way he was?
I think a little bit of all of the above. Mm. You have to remember, so Darwin's established. Darwin is, in fact, one of Wallace's heroes. Yeah. One of the reasons Wallace ventures out on these great expeditions to the tropics is because he's been inspired by reading Darwin. Mm. And he also aspires to write a book like The Voyage of the Beagle. Darwin is his hero. And he's a nobody. He gets... By virtue of the co-publication, suddenly he's got what he wanted. And that's the point. He got what he wanted, which was access to the scientific big time. He made it,
right,
if you like. That's what he wanted. He didn't want anything else. Now he was in a position to, you know, people would listen to what he said. People would read what he wrote. Okay. So I just don't think he was that interested in then sort of battling away for more prominence or whatever. He got what he wanted. He crossed that threshold from obscurity to being a somebody. My favorite illustration of this, by the way, and it's also more powerful in many ways than the choosing of the book title Darwinism, is he wrote this fantastic book. And by the way, it hugely transcends Darwin, in my opinion. Darwin's Voyage of the Beagle is a great book of travel writing. The Malay Archipelago is a winner. I mean, everyone should be forced to read it. Strike that. it's an 8-year journey. And there's all sorts of awful things happening. He's nearly drowning several times. People working with him die. He nearly dies several times. I mean, it's high drama. And it's a very personal account because, you know, this is him going out alone, more or less, traveling around all over the place. So it's almost a diary. And, in fact, one of the nice reviews that came out was critical of the fact that he seemed to have been so conscientious in literally putting almost every day into this book. It's so dense. Does he talk about evolution in that book? Does he talk about the two great insights that he had, which produced, as I said, the first half, the descent with modification and then natural selection? These are the two great insights he had while traveling in Southeast Asia. Does he mention them? No, not at all. Does he mention the theory of evolution? Yes, repeatedly. In what context? As Mr. Darwin's theory.
Wow.
So yes, self-marketing was not his was not his strong suit.
You describe, well, he's having been born in genteel poverty, I think is how you put it in one piece. Middle class family in decline, I guess. In Wales, he's born. What insights do we get from that background into the man he would become? How does he catch on to science?
So the first thing to say is he's poor. So even though, yes, he comes from the right side of the tracks. I mean, his parents are middle class, but his father was a trust fund kid who invested badly, basically, yeah. And couldn't hold down a job, essentially. So they didn't have any money, which meant that he was basically uneducated. He left school at the age of 13 and had to work for a living. And that's where he became interested in a very, very amateurish way in science. He was working with his older brother, who was a surveyor. So they were mapping out parcels of the English countryside, which meant he spent day in, day out wandering around the fields of Britain, measuring distances and angles. Mm-hmm. And he became interested in the flowers that he saw around him in a completely naive and ignorant way. He bought a book to help him understand what he was actually looking at, what the difference between a harebell and a bluebell is, and a cowslip and a primrose. Mm. And he got the wrong book. He saved for months to get this wonderful book on systematic botany. It turned out to be a book that described the structure of xylem and other features of plant tissue. So it was absolutely useless. I mean, he was completely naive. And it wasn't until a few years later, when he was in his very early 20s, when he met another young self-taught naturalist, a man called Bates, Henry Walter Bates. And Bates was actually 2 years younger, but he was more sophisticated than Wallace in his sort of proto-science, and he was a beetle guy. And it was Bates who converted, for want of a better term, Wallace into a beetle guy, and that was when it really took off. And partly because he had, a sparring partner in Bates, and they wrote the nerdiest beetle-centric correspondence you'll ever read. It's all about seeing this there and seeing that there, and can we get that in that cabinet, and so on and so forth. So that was the genesis of his interest in science.
It's there's a terrific biography of A.R. Wallace from Peter Raby, and he writes about this moment when he is, I'm just imagining him wandering around the countryside in Wales with Bates. And in 1847, he writes this to Bates. He says, I begin to feel rather dissatisfied with a mere local collection. They're collecting these beetles. And he says, I should like to take some one family to study thoroughly, principally, with a view to the theory of the origin of species. So he wants to go, they want to get out of the countryside, right? They want to go on an expedition, and they propose to go, I guess, to the Brazilian Amazon, which I've read at one point. That was akin to saying, let's go to Mars. I mean, this was a remarkable idea.
Yeah, a couple of comments there. One is, it was reading Darwin and von Humboldt and other scientific travelers that sort of opened these young, local know-nothings to the possibility of actually going places and doing science. But they'd also read a sort of potboiler, a Victorian bestseller, early Victorian bestseller, which was sort of presented a half-baked and very poorly developed theory of evolution. It was called The Species Question or The Origin of Species. And it was at that moment that he becomes very interested in this idea that maybe there's more to biological diversity than meets the eye. And so with these sort of little shards of readings and this enthusiasm for beetles, this guy, I think, is one of the boldest things anyone's ever done. This is not Darwin. Darwin goes off on the Voyage of the Beagle, right? That's a Royal Naval Surveying Expedition. Yeah. These boys are basically paying their own way. They're going to make money by sending back extra specimens, which can be sold to museums and to gentlemen collectors. And off they go. Into, well, not the heart of darkness, I suppose, but the heart of Brazil.
Andrew Berry is with us. He is a lecturer on evolutionary biology at Harvard University. We're talking about A.R. Wallace, We'll talk more when we get back from a break. We invite you to join us, by the way, if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. There is a short documentary called The Animated Life of A.R. Wallace. It gave us the idea in the first place, co-produced in part by Flora Lichtman. It's going to be on our website, Video West. We'll put that up just after the program. We're going to take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling the story behind a short film we're featuring on our website, Video West. It comes from former Science Friday producer Flora Lichtman. It's the really fascinating story of the visionary scientist and explorer Alfred Russel Wallace. Not many have heard of him. It so happens that he discovered the theory of evolution by natural selection pretty much at the same time as Darwin, but for all kinds of different reasons. Darwin gets most of that credit. We're talking with Andrew Berry, an evolutionary biologist and a lecturer at Harvard University. He edited a collection of A.R. Wallace's writings in a book called Infinite Tropics. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So we're talking about Wallace and Bates, and they head off into the Brazilian Amazon, and Wallace decides to head back to England. This is in 1852. He spent 4 years there. And this is where the story starts to get really good, because he has this, in some ways, terrible stroke of luck. And it turns out that it worked out fairly well for him. But describe what the voyage is like back, because he has what you describe as this kind of small menagerie of living animals that he wants to bring back with him.
So remember, he's out there collecting, and he's really out in the middle of nowhere,
right.
Sort of uncontacted native groups and so on. I mean, really, and he's everything that he's collecting is new to science. So what he's going to bring back, he's a nobody. He's going to come back into London a serious scientific somebody, because he's got all this amazing stuff, all these extraordinary species and so on. And I think this is such a nice touch from his point of view, he's bringing a zoo with him, 30-odd living animals, a spider monkey. Just imagine walking into a tight-laced scientific salon in Victorian Britain with a toucan with that fantastic multicolored bill poking out that astride your arm. That was his vision. And as you say, it wasn't to be realized. About 3 weeks into the voyage from Belém back to the UK, aboard the good ship Helen, and I love this detail, the captain, he was the only passenger, he was sharing a cabin with the captain. The captain comes and says, "Mr. Wallace, I think you should know, the ship's on fire." And this, of course, is a wooden ship. It's been in the tropics for too long. The thing goes up like a tinderbox.
Yeah.
And the story is, it's horrific, actually. Wallace barely has time to grab a small case of what he happened to be working on at the time, just a little, like a couple of shoeboxes, basically. And that's all he gets. Everything else is gone. He actually gets bad rope burns on his hands as he slides down the rope down the side of the ship to get into the lifeboat. What are you going to do if you're the captain? Your ship's on fire. You've got two lifeboats. You're literally in the middle of the Atlantic. Well, they figure, and it seemed the smart thing to do, was they'll wait and hope that the burning wreck attracts shipping in the area and they'll be rescued. So Wallace, for the next 24 hours, circles the burning wreck, and he writes incredibly poignantly, those animals which were going to be his ticket to the big time, those the toucans and the spider monkeys and everything else, they have sprung from their cages by the flames, and they go out to the bowsprit, which is the last bit of the boat that's not on fire, and throw themselves back into the flames. Wallace watches that, and so he's lost everything. Then he actually spends 10 days adrift. They weren't rescued for 10 days. So they're very, very – well, they basically were out of water by the time they were rescued. But he is – and I love this sort of component of the story. He is still British and Victorian. So there's a lovely account he writes 4 days or 4 nights into this ordeal. He says, "Saw several shooting stars last night, and in fact could not have been in a better position for observing them than lying on my back in a small boat in the middle of the Atlantic." That's putting a positive spin on things.
I liked that story because I think it reflected his character, even later when it comes to his luck related to Darwin. seems to take things off fairly well. But you describe it as one of the most poignant scenes in the history of science in some way.
I really think it is. It's extraordinarily tragic. There's also all sorts of back detail. For example, I felt incredibly sad and guilty about the fact his younger brother had come out mid-expedition to help him out. His younger brother had then headed home. Wallace is way upriver, up the Rio Negro, and hears that his brother has contracted yellow fever. But he then doesn't hear for many months whether he survived the bout of yellow fever. And he eventually learns that his brother has died. And he feels, and there's this sort of pall of guilt that hangs over it. So in a sense, the loss is even greater. Not only has lost all his own work, all those specimens, the loss to science, but he's also sort of lost the memorial that was to be his brother's monument, if you like.
What does it do to him? What does he figure is next for him when he does well, finally make it back?
This is why Wallace is a better human being than the rest of us. I don't know about you, but I would throw. Okay. Yes, I'm going to become an accountant, or something yeah. rather landlocked and safe. And yeah. in fact, he writes a letter as soon as he gets back to England. He says, "I'm never going to see again." That was no thanks. Okay.
Okay.
Fairly rapidly, he realizes, actually, if he wants to actually follow through and live the dream, so to speak, actually realize that goal of becoming a man of science, no, he's got to do it again. Yeah. He's got nothing, essentially. He came his 4 years wasted, in a sense. And so this is the resilient Wallace, and the resilient capital R. Within 18 months, he was once more on a boat, this time heading to Singapore. From where he spent 8 years island hopping all the way through modern Indonesia, a lot of time in Borneo, even making it to the western reaches of the great island of New Guinea.
It's interesting because you mentioned the catastrophe with the boat catching on fire. Turns out to be kind of a blessing in disguise because it forces him to go on this second expedition, which you mentioned really completes his education. He's able to make these comparisons and these connections, old world to new world.
Well, it's a slightly Panglossian way to say a disaster like that. Woohoo! Yes, yeah, I've right. got to go somewhere else. So, no, but it was serendipitously, you're right. He had very intense first-hand experience of the New World tropics and everything that's going on there. And he has intense first-hand experience of the old world, of Indonesia. And it instantly raises questions, okay? So here we are. There are two places which are actually sort of ostensibly rather similar. The similar latitudes, fairly similar climates, okay? Completely different groups of plants and animals.
Yeah.
Now, if you've got a designer, which remember is the default hypothesis at this time
right.
for how biological diversity arose, who's matching things to their environments, you've got two environments which frankly are rather similar. So why would you put different things there?
Mm.
So hence Wallace is beginning to think about sort of historical processes and this tie-in between the biological turnover of species and the geological changes on the surface of the planet.
So he starts to see the origin of the species as a genealogical process.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to take a simple example, he looks at Australia and New Guinea
yeah.
where you've got lots of kangaroos. Okay, you don't have any monkeys in New Guinea. You have tree kangaroos, which are some of the clumsiest creatures yet devised. Why do you have so many of one group in one place? Well, think about it. It makes sense. The first one arose there, and you've got a genealogical process whereby new ones are spun off from ancestral ones. It's almost a syllogism. It almost has to be inevitable.
It's interesting. You talk about this pattern spawning, which leads him to to another concept, the so-called biological species concept, which I guess he doesn't really get credit for, or not much credit for. But he has these really remarkable insights there. I mean, they're really innovative, I suppose.
Oh, absolutely brilliant. I mean, and it's the mix of really intense engagement with what he's seeing. As you say, his capacity as an observer, it's this onboard databasing and understanding where that new butterfly that he's seen on this new island fits in with the other ones. Is that with a true synthetic vision
yeah.
that puts these things together. I mean, he would have called it theoretical. I suppose. The irony, by the way, and again, this is classic Wallace. So remember, Wallace is, he doesn't have any money, so he's bankrolling these expeditions, and the same was true in Southeast Asia, by selling specimens. He has an agent in London who he's sending the stuff to, and the guy's then placing them at museums and so on. Yeah. And Wallace publishes his first, what we'll call a theoretical paper, which is a big deal because previously he's just been doing sort of detailed natural history type science. He publishes this paper, and Wallace is sort of excited. He's expecting there to be pushback by the scientific bigwigs in London and so on. But nobody pushes back. Nobody even notices. And he gets this slightly apologetic note from the agent saying, look, Mr. Wallace, please get back to collecting species. I can't sell theories. You're not doing yourself any favors right. with all this theorizing.
Yet it's interesting that he comes upon, I wanted to have you talk about this moment. Maybe it wasn't exactly a moment, but it does seem like there's this epiphany, and it almost comes at a moment when he has this bout of, he's being eaten by bugs, and he has these bouts of malaria, and he's in a fever at this one particular moment where I'm not sure if it is a eureka moment, but it seems like a crucial kind of moment. You want to take us through that?
I would say it's, I mean, it depends how you define your eureka moment. He didn't leap out of his bath and run naked through the streets of Athens, but it was, so far as we know, and this is the slightly irritating thing with Wallace, he's so busy being modest that he doesn't write down what happened until many years afterwards. Mm-hmm. So it's always possible that he's trying to, you know, make what was a rather boring story. He read some books and thought hard about something and then came up with an idea into something slightly more interesting. But no, he was, and it's almost certainly on the island of what he called Gilolo, or today we call Halmahera, which is a fairly large and largely then uninhabited island in the Moluccan Islands of Indonesia. And yes, feverish, thrashing around. This is February 1858. But always thinking. And that's the great thing. He's this nuts and bolts details guy. He's sort of trying to distinguish this beetle from that one, that butterfly from this one. And he's packing them up and shipping them back to his agent and so on. But the whole time he's pulling the camera back, so to speak, and thinking big picture. And he got it.
Yeah.
Now, as I say, it's debated as to what exactly, and various people have different ideas, and partly because, as I say, he didn't do us the favor of writing it all down for us at the time. Oh, I was thinking about this. This led to that and so on. But one thing we do know is that he recognized that this was a good idea. And the first thing he wanted to do as soon as he was capable of picking up a pen, was he was going to send this idea off to the one person in England who had expressed an interest in his, shall we say, theoretical ideas previously, his hero, Charles Darwin. Now, that, by the way, and I always say this is the luckiest thing that ever happened to Charles Darwin.
Yeah.
Charles Darwin, at that stage, he'd basically generated the theory within a few years of the return of the Voyage of the Beagle. So we're now in 1858. Darwin had a manuscript from 1844, which had a pretty complete, it wasn't 100%, but it was a pretty complete theory of evolution by natural selection. And what he's done ever since is consolidate. Mm-hmm. And he was sort of reluctantly, I mean, it's a big element of procrastination with Charles Darwin on right. this one. He's reluctantly sort of dragging himself forward to write this massive, concrete, solid, watertight case that would be his, as he called it, big species book. So he gets this letter.
Yeah.
Woohoo! Now, as I say, it's the luckiest thing that ever happened to him because every other paper Wallace had sent directly to a journal, right? So it would have been reviewed or whatever and come out 3 months later. Darwin would have received a copy of the journal. There would be the theory of what would become called theory of evolution by natural selection with the name, the sole name, A.R. Wallace over the top. What actually happened was poor old Darwin, you know, he's been working on this. This is his baby. He's been quietly gestating this thing for 20, 25 years, right? And suddenly, bang, this nobody he's exchanged a handful of letters with has laid out his whole argument in this single rather elegant manuscript. So Darwin goes into a tailspin. Things are really bad for Darwin. Darwin's infant child, 18-month-old son, is dying in his house at the time, probably from scarlet fever. So his life's work has just been wrenched from him. Junior's in bad shape. Darwin is sort of paralyzed. And he says, the one thing that I don't want to do is I don't want to be perceived as acting in a paltry spirit towards Mr. Wallace.
Right.
I mean, I know this is a nobody. I know that I've been working on this a lot longer than Mr. Wallace, but you know, we've got to do right by Mr. Wallace, which I have to say redounds absolutely in Darwin's favor. Mm-hmm. I mean, Darwin could have burnt your manuscript and said, oh, never arrived. Sorry. Oh, you sent me a paper, did you?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And it was Darwin's sort of senior scientific colleagues, confidants, geologist Charles Lyell and Joseph Dalton Hooker, who was a botanist. So they arranged for a joint – it's a bizarre. It's not a co-publication because these were two separate announcements of the same theory by two separate people in a single session at the London elite science organization, the Linnaean Society. So that was actually on the 1st of July. So the letter arrived 18th of June, 1858, in Darwin's hands. And within, 2 weeks, the publication, which is the reading out of the paper, first occurs. And that is Darwin and Wallace. Now, what Darwin then does, as you know, is gets moving.
Yeah.
Within a little more than a year, The Origin of Species is published. Wallace, what happens to Wallace? Now, I don't know about you, but I might feel slightly irked as a scientist if I send a manuscript to a colleague, and next time I turn around, I find that it's been published, and in fact, I'm second author. This is Darwin and Wallace.
Right.
I might object. Wallace, and there's this lovely letter that he writes his mother. He gets a letter explaining what's happened. This is October 1858. Now, he's still, of course, way out in the middle of nowhere in Indonesia.
Yeah.
Gets a letter, and he writes to his mother, you know, this is the best thing that could have happened. Okay? Because now, finally, the big people, they're taking me seriously. I've arrived, is essentially what he's saying. And you can read that letter. You can almost hear him jumping up and down with excitement. Which is why, even though, and there is not a single moment in all of his correspondence, in all of his copious published writings, where Wallace complains about being unfairly treated or hard done by or in any way unfairly eclipsed by Darwin.
I have to say, it is intriguing that that moment. Now, it's clear, you say, Wallace was not telling Darwin anything that he didn't already know. But the moment when he gets the manuscript, when it's there in front of him, I mean, the ethical questions for Darwin, which it seems he was going over and over again, should he have let Wallace take the credit? Should they have? I mean, they end up sharing it, of course. But it does seem, even though his friends, Darwin's friends, are saying, look, you may get scooped on this thing. They sounded more panicked than maybe Darwin was. But I guess he behaved above board. But he must have wondered what to do, as you say.
He certainly wondered. But as I say, I think all the documentary evidence indicates that in wondering, his priority was he wanted to do the right thing. Look, the other thing is, you think, well, what does Darwin really care? The important thing is the idea that it's out there, whether it's got his name or not. And of course he cares. That's true of anyone who's a scientist, anyone who has spent years of their life nursing their idea, especially, you know, an idea which is heretical and problematic as this one is or was at the time. It was hugely important to him. And yet, no, as I say, I think Darwin comes out of the whole episode clean as a whistle.
Yeah. And Wallace was so gracious, so accommodating. He mentions that at the time of his eureka moment, he said he had been the young man in a hurry. Whereas Darwin was more patient, less impulsive. He gives Darwin credit there.
Yeah, well, Wallace is, as I say, almost over the top in terms of his deference to Darwin. And I say it's psychologically complicated because this is Wallace's childhood hero or young person's hero that he's dealing with. So he's always got that slightly second tier relationship to Darwin. But having said that, moving forward, when Wallace stayed out for several more years in Southeast Asia. He came back in 1862. And then these guys, they agreed on many things. And indeed, Wallace became a sort of mini Huxley. Huxley was famously Darwin's bulldog. Yeah. Darwin stayed at home. It was too sort of genteel and a little bit poorly. He didn't seek the smoke of battle. He sent out his bulldog to do that. And Wallace did a fair bit of that, actually, a fair bit of sort of defending the Darwinian orthodoxy. But eventually they came to have some fairly serious disagreements. Right. And it's a pleasure to read the correspondence between them. It's very detailed, and they're really hashing out the issues, but it's so respectful and so engaging. There's this lovely moment when the two big issues they disagreed was the evolution of humans and on sexual selection, which was Darwin's sort of second theory of selection, which explains not just survival characteristics but traits like the peacock's tail that allow access to the opposite sex. Wallace didn't like sexual selection. Darwin writes a book in 1871, which is about human evolution and sexual selection. This is his second great book, The Descent of Man. Right. And he writes rather sheepishly to Wallace. He says, look, we've had our disagreements, and the slightly unfortunate thing about my latest book project is I've condensed into this single book everything we disagree on. Okay? Right. Wallace writes back, and Wallace is, I love this, he writes back, my dear Darwin, I very much look forward to reading your new book, and I look forward, too, to being crushed by the mountain of your facts. Isn't that fantastic? He's just like, bring it on, man. It's just the attitude of healthy debate is so much a part of what these guys were about. It's a pleasure to read, and one only wishes that it was more a feature of modern science.
You know, the more you read about Wallace, the more you come to understand why it is he didn't achieve the same kind of celebrity status as Darwin. I mean, his social and political views couldn't have helped his reputation or his acclaim. I get a sense that in some way he's sort of the Noam Chomsky of his time. You've described him as the prototype of the socially engaged scientist.
Yes, I think I actually quite like the analogy to Noam Chomsky. I mean, everyone respects Noam Chomsky for his linguistics, but half the establishment at least thinks he's a complete cuckoo when it comes to talking about Israel or talking about politics or socialism or whatever. It was kind of the same way with Wallace. He wrote after a review of his autobiography, which he published in 1905, he said, it's just like everything else. The reviewer praises my science to high heaven and then says, on everything else, I'm a weak, foolish, giggling baby. I think that's very unfortunate because I think it's sad because I think Noam Chomsky serves a fantastic purpose. I think too many of us scientists are too busily, defensively locked in our little ivory towers. You know, there are all sorts of important issues out there, whether it's genetically modified foodstuffs or global warming. These are scientific issues. We scientists, thank you, Wallace, shouldn't leave them to these incendiary, important, socially dynamic issues in the hands of politicians and activists.
It's interesting. He didn't really have he left organized religion fairly early in his life, but he did have what you sort of refer to as this hankering for something spiritual to fill the void. And I guess this is another reason why people wonder about, you know, that sort of slightly cuckoo part of his, you know, he had the spiritualism, the phrenology, all of those kinds of things did kind of raise questions about. But was it God? I mean, because that was one of the things that he wondered about evolution, that it didn't account for a God, maybe.
Well, no, absolutely wasn't God. He disavowed organized religion. So what did he believe in? I don't think we really know. He was a spiritualist. Yeah. So after he came back from Indonesia, a few years afterwards, he went, and it was very fashionable at that stage. And there were, by the way, plenty of other scientists. He wasn't sort of loony fringe completely on this. He started going to seances, and he became completely convinced. And he has this ability to become a zealot. It was like Beatles. Mm. You know, after Bates converted him to a Beatle enthusiast, suddenly he did nothing else. He thought about nothing else. It was Beatles, Beatles, Beatles. In a sense, it's this, within a year of going to his first seance, he's publishing on what he perceives to be the science of spiritualism. He decides this is just a different, if you like, modality. And he uses nice analogies. He says, look, here's a drop. 500 years ago, if I took a drop of water out of the River Thames and told you, straight face, it's full of tiny little animals swimming around, you'd have laughed at me and said, no, it's just a drop of water. But with the invention of the microscope, now we're both on the same page, right? He's saying maybe that's the same with a spirit world, that we just don't have the technology at the moment to be aware of them, but they're there nevertheless. It's a scientific endeavor, if you like, to try and understand more about these things. Now, whether you call that religion or not, he certainly had a belief in the supernatural.
Yeah, and his ideas about race also made him raise questions about natural selection.
Well, he was, in general, wonderfully progressive in this regard. Yeah. I mean, even the most liberal of the Victorians, and Darwin included, were good abolitionists. You know, slavery was morally abhorrent. But they were still probably ultimately racists in that they, most of them at least, would have believed that the white Victorian male, so sexist as well, was, you know, if you like, the pinnacle of creation or evolution, if that's your mode of discourse. Wallace, remember, had been traveling around, literally dependent upon locals. So he's living in a mud hut with some guy whose idea of Sunday best is some grass tied around his waist. And he recognized that these are savages. I mean, that's a term of art in Victorian time, that the savage is every bit as mentally, emotionally, and, physically capable, probably more so, capable than he is. That's great. So he's sort of an unracist assertion. But it creates problems for him scientifically, because the question then arises, how could natural selection give this guy who lives in New Guinea the potential to play the piano beautifully when he's never seen a piano and never will see a piano, okay? So a natural selection can't do that, and Wallace is right in this regard. So his retreat, which is, I think, is a cop-out, is to assume that there was, in the evolution of humans and humans alone in their mental attributes, there was some divine intervention. Now, look, as a spiritualist, he's got to believe that anyway, because if every human has a spirit, that's a non-material part which got injected somewhere. That wasn't natural selection that did that. So his views on the evolution of humans is a slightly weird mix of his spiritualism and actually fairly interesting and sophisticated scientific reasoning. But it did lead him, and this was the biggie, in terms of his disagreement with Darwin. In 1869, so this is 10 years after the publication of The Origin of Species, he comes out and says, natural selection accounts for everything on the face of the planet except one thing, and that's our own species. And that's because we're a special species endowed with spirit.
It's Andrew Berry, evolutionary biologist, lecturer at Harvard University, edited a book of A.R. Wallace's writing, and the collection is titled Infinite Tropics. He joined us from the studio on the campus of Harvard in Cambridge. Andrew Berry, thank you for the time.
My pleasure.
There is a short documentary called The Animated Life of A.R. Wallace. It's going to be on our website, Video West. We'll put that up just after the program. We're going to take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling the story behind a short film we're featuring on our website, Video West. It's the fascinating story of the visionary scientist and explorer Alfred Russel Wallace. We're joined now by Sharon Shattuck, who co-produced the short documentary, The Animated Life of A.R. Wallace, which we're going to be showcasing starting today on our website, Video West. And she's joining us by phone from her office in Brooklyn. Sharon, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So one of the questions we put to Andrew Berry here earlier was, what was the thing that got him thinking about A.R. Wallace? What's the thing that got you, how did you come upon this story?
Well, it's a long journey. I started out in botany. That was my focus as an undergrad, and I was working at a field station in Michigan, and a friend of mine mentioned A.R. Wallace, or Alfred Russel Wallace, to me. And so I started looking into him more, and I just really kind of fell in love with his story, and I kind of have a little bit of an appreciation for the underdog. And so in some ways, he just really appealed to me.
You went to Singapore and Borneo to retrace all of these steps. I mean, what did you learn there about Wallace?
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, so we originally conceptualized this video as a documentary. And so we brought a camera and went to Singapore and to Borneo and retraced some of Wallace's steps. Yeah. And what we found was, when we were talking to all of these experts, we found that he really has a lasting legacy in that part of the world. A lot of people, like a lot of field scientists, still really identify strongly with Wallace because he was maybe a little bit of a scrappy guy, and he just kind of forged ahead and didn't really let, any obstacles get in his way.
So in the end, you end up not doing a full-length documentary, although maybe you'll come back with it, but you decide to tell the story with paper puppets. Since we're running out of time, let me ask you, what was it, after cutting all of these little bits of colorful paper and creating the story, what was your takeaway for this story for Wallace?
I'm just really impressed with how resolute he was and how he would just continue on. I mean, he survived a shipwreck, and his brother died in the course of working in South America, and he just kept forging ahead, searching for this big question, or searching for the answer to the question. And I just really admire him. And I think, the paper was kind of it's something that Flora and I love to do. We did another piece a few years ago for Radiolab called Whale Fall in the same style. And it's just, it's a method of showing history in a different way from just doing like a typical recreation.
That's Sharon Shattuck. She co-produced, along with Flora Lichtman, the short documentary, The Animated Life of A.R. Wallace, which we're showing now on our website, Video West. Sharon joined us from her office in Brooklyn. Sharon, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Go to videowest.kuer.org to see that. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.